Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Mark Gaberti, and this is the podcast for entrepreneurs who are looking for the breakthrough for their businesses. Depending on the questions you ask, you can learn a lot during a conversation. So after interviewing hundreds of people for breakthrough success in my virtual summits, I've amassed more knowledge than I could have dreamed of because I started interviewing all these leaders within my niche. So imagine what you could do if you've interviewed over 4,000 people and count. Believe it or not, there is someone who has done that. And even more shocking, he's on the Breakthrough Success podcast today. So today's guest is the host of the top-rated Conversations with Passion radio show and a columnist for prominent publications. He has had the privilege of interviewing over 4,000 of the world's top leaders in search of the traits that set them apart. Today's guest shares his insights on various stages, including multiple TEDx appearances. The keynote speaker has presented to over 200,000 attendees and has shared the stage with legends like Deepak Chopra, Stephen M. R. Covey, television personalities, and more. Today's guest for episode 122 of the Breakthrough Success Podcast is none other than Corey Poirier. Corey, it is such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Awesome, Mark. I am super stoked to be here and looking forward to hopefully making some magic happen today.
I'm really looking forward to make that magic happen too. And I mean, when we first kicked it off with the Productivity Virtual Summit, I mean, I was blown away. So I knew I had to have you come back on the podcast. And I mean, interviewing 4,000 people, that's just so many hours. Like, I don't even know if you put all that together, like how many months that actually is, but why did you start interviewing people? What first got you into that?
So it's interesting because I think one of the key questions people either ask or they're wanting to ask and don't ask is how is it even possible? You know, how are those numbers possible? And it relates to how it started, which is that back when I was, interestingly enough, I know you just turned 20. So back when I was 19, I had a small business publication and I was interviewing people. Essentially, it was how I was paying the bills. And I was interviewing people and sharing their stories. And it was very early on in it. I wasn't skilled in it. I wanted to do it because I thought it'd be great if entrepreneurs could learn from other entrepreneurs. And it seemed to be the best way to do it in the small community where I live. And that's how it started. And then what happened from there is I put that aside, moved away from it for quite some time. And then about 2007, I actually think it was July, I relaunched a similar publication. And what happened is for that publication, ended up doing 80 to 100 interviews a month to keep the publication filled with content. And I could have hired freelancers to do all of the interviews, but I sort of became obsessed by it. And so when you start crunching the numbers, that publication ran monthly for about close to 6 years, between 5 and 6. So, you know, you start crunching the numbers of 60 to 80 interviews on some months. And you multiply that by 6 months and you start to see, or 6 years, and you start to see where the numbers sort of come in. And then what happened is about 5 years ago, I seen that print, even though it was still doing okay in the community where I had the publication and we were still growing, I knew I was limited. Like, print was dying. I mean, it's not dead, but it was going in the wrong direction. And so I knew that I couldn't expand it if I wanted it to be a bigger thing than it was. So I decided to make the transition over to podcasting and radio, again, about 5 years ago. And then I continued doing interviews, but just in this more of this format rather than print. So the two-part answer is, how did those interviews all come together? Well, probably about 65 to 70% of those was from that publication I had, which for visual for people would be like Success Magazine for a little regional area. And then transitioning over to the radio show. But why I kept doing it and how I get into it is because once I started, I became literally obsessed by wanting to learn what these high achievers did differently and did well so that I could share with others so that maybe they could shortcut their learning curve and the process of trying to crush it rather than having to learn in the trenches. Maybe they could learn a little bit by other people's failures and successes and life steps.
Now, I was trying to do the math for myself because, I mean, 4,000 interviews is a lot, and I typically give out a 45-minute slot for all the interviews for the Breakthrough Success podcast in case some of them go overtime or to just count for anything that could possibly happen. And some of them do end up going over that 45-minute time frame. But just for me to think about like how many minutes that is for 4,000. I mean, like, I feel like if you gave me more time to sit and think about it, like I'd be able to give you an actual number. It's like 180 and then like a few more extra zeros. But like, I mean, that's so much time to commit to interviewing that many people. So how were you able to find the time to interview all these people and still be able to do all the activities you're supposed to do to generate income?
Yeah, so great question. And by the way, Mark, I just did the math as well for you, and I averaged it because some interviews have gone over an hour. I mean, you know, if I go back, I don't know the number of that, but let's say it was 600 out of 4,000, and we're over 4,000 now. But if we just take 4,000 as a round number, and we say an hour per interview as an average, because very few were under an hour, because even ones I knew I was going to only use 30 minutes, I said, well, we might as well have the extra time in case. So if we took the average of 4,000 interviews at an average of an hour an interview, that's 240,000 minutes. So I've never done that math before. So thank you for making me realize how many minutes of my life I've spent doing interviews. But yeah, in terms of how did I find the time? So one of the good things, I guess, about the publication is that when I was doing the interviews through it, is that that was a key function of the publication. So the only two things really from my end that kept the publication rolling was the content, meaning the interviews, and the sales. So the advertising, because we sold advertisements in the publication. And so basically I just divided my month, and if we want to call it our genius zone, I mean, I don't know if that was my genius zone, but it was the two areas that needed to be done for the publication to survive. And so basically I just spent my month, each month, doing just those two things. I hired a designer to design the publication. I had somebody hired to distribute the papers to where they had to go. And basically pretty much my whole month was just doing interviews and selling ad space. So it was kind of like it wasn't right down the middle, but kind of like a 20 hours a week selling ads, and then 20 hours a week doing the interviews. And so that's kind of how I did it. I mean, I just really focused on only those two things. If I come back to now, how do I do it? It's totally different, because now what I do is I do a lot of batching. So when I say that, not everybody is maybe familiar with that term, but essentially I set aside a certain day or 2 days a week, and that's all interview day. It's mostly one day. And now these days, it's pretty tough for me to get 2 days in of that. But when I do the batching, it's not abnormal for me to do, let's say, the craziest days would be like 10 interviews a day. And then some days it'd be like 6 or 7, but I basically batch it all to that one day. But then again, you can start seeing that if you're doing on a busy one, eight interviews on a Tuesday, let's say, you multiply that by 4 weeks, I'm still, you know, still being able to get 30 to 35 interviews done on a month, even at that stage, you know, more than one a day. So really it's just now it's about batching, and I only dedicate one day to it. And back then it was because I could actually dedicate over or almost 50% of my time to doing the interviews. So it's just really a matter of how I structured it. I think, you know, it's kind of one of those things that if you say yes to certain things, you're saying no to something else. So what I did was I said no to all the things that at that time wasn't related to interviews or selling the space in the publication, so I could say yes to those two things.
And it's interesting how you talk about when you were doing these interviews, it was you were able to publish them in the magazine. And that was your primary method, creating content and making sure you had ad partners. But for most of the people doing interviews now, it's now through something like a podcast. And it's not like people with podcasts, like they never really just have a podcast. Like, I feel like podcasting is that platform you figure out after you've used a bunch of other ones. So like, I feel like you have like a blog or maybe a YouTube channel or social media and a few other things that go along with the podcast, stuff that you did beforehand. So how would you recommend still having that level of focus when you're able to interview people and still focus on those generating revenue generating activities without getting so like distracted? Like, there's so many different things that we could be doing now that feel like they're moving the needle forward, but it's a matter of picking the right things that move the needle forward the best way.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Mark, I'll share with you the little system I have. that allows me to decide what a yes and no is, because this ties right into what you mentioned about how do we decide what to spend our time on, and then basically, you know, get disciplined and spend that time. So what I do, I have this system that I put together a while back, and I recommend everybody at least put some form of this together. And what it was for me is I actually sat down and asked myself, what is my, let's call it purpose statement. What most people would know it as is a mission statement, because that's what a company would call it. But I said, what's my purpose statement? What am I actually here to do? And so I came up with this five-part system. And basically what it was, what I came around to the idea is that what I want to spend my time doing and be the guy who is doing was donating, motivating, inspiring, educating, and entertaining. And so it took me a while to come around to that. But once I sat down and you know, rolled the sleeves up and figured out that that was what my purpose was, those five things, then here's how I choose what I spend my time on, which then allows me to focus on those things, is that basically when something comes across my table, my mind, my desk, or a task that comes up or something, you know, an opportunity comes up, what I do is I ask, how many of those five is it? And if something's only one of those five, it becomes marked the easiest no without regret ever. If something comes up four or five times, it becomes a really easy yes. And so what that allows me to do is I can test almost anything, any opportunity against that and say, is this the best use of my time? Is this going to move the needle forward? Because anything that's four or five of those is moving the needle forward for me. But by doing that, what I've found is, let's say 80% of the opportunities that come up or things that come my way or things that need doing, upwards of 80% don't move the needle. And before, I would have just put them all on my to-do list and done them. And so for me now, knowing what moves the needle, and to me that what that is basically living on purpose. And those are those five things for me. And so that could look like it could be taking an interview on a great show like yours, Mark, here. It could be speaking at a conference. And basically, again, I can ask with any of those opportunities, is it those five? How many of those five does it hit? And once it hits 80% or more, it becomes that easy yes. But like I said, everything else becomes either a no or let's think about this a little bit. And that system has allowed me to understand the power of no and start saying no more than I ever did in the past. And an interesting finding in all of these interviews I've done is one of the top three traits of the highest of achievers is that they understand the importance of saying no and what to say no to so that they can say yes to those few little things that will create the difference. So that's my system for doing it. And why I started doing it is because I learned that it was one of those top traits. And the better you are at doing it, the better you're going to be at being disciplined and staying focused. And as you said, not jumping on all those opportunities that could easily distract you. So the podcasting for me, having the show and doing those interviews, that is hits all those five. But again, what I do is I batch it to one day and say, unless there's some unique circumstance, it doesn't go to another day. I mean, there's obviously, you know, circumstances where you have to say, okay, I'm going to schedule this on a Thursday, but 99% of the time it sticks to the Tuesday and I don't deviate. So it's the discipline of it, but it's also, like I say, having a system that allows me to do that. So the takeaway, you know, if you're listening right now is what is your mission statement? Ask yourself that question. Get down with a pen and a piece of paper or whatever else you use, find out your mission statement. And once you can figure out what you're here to do and what your purpose is, and can spend most of your time in that area, it allows you to stay disciplined and avoid some of those distractions.
Now, I really want to dive into all these traits that successful people have in common, the power of no being something that I feel like we should all be adopting, because even when we say yes, we're definitely saying no to other things. But just before we do that, just one more question about how you've been able to conduct all these interviews. I mean, part of that time is sitting down with the person, interviewing the person, much like what we're doing right now. But there's also that behind the scenes stuff. There's crafting the intro. There's thinking of the good questions. So how are you able to prepare for all those interviews? Like, I can understand preparing for one interview, but how would you find the time and develop that work ethic so you could at that like peak level prepare for like 60 to 80 or even more interviews in a given month?
So happy to answer that, Mark. And it's funny, just before I move away from the other, one thing that I wanted to share, add in terms of the avoiding the distractions, because I think it could be beneficial for listeners as well. But in terms of another thing that I do, and you asked, how do I sort of stay disciplined and avoid the distraction? I'll give you a quick metaphor. Basically, and I've shared this during talks in the past, but if I have a tub of ice cream in the house, I'm going to tell you that I'll only eat one or two spoonfuls. And then an hour later, when the whole tub's gone, I'll say, oh, I didn't mean to eat all that. Or I'll just say, next time I'll only eat one or two spoonfuls. So what I've learned is that if I have ice cream in the house, I'm going to eat it. Much the same way, if I have the distractions in front of me, so in other words, if I have my phone ringing, if I have all kinds of notifications on, I'm going to get distracted. I am a type A personality. I chase the shiny objects. So what I found is I had to be disciplined enough to say, okay, I'm going to forward my phone to the office. I'm going to put my texts and everything else on either vibration or silent. And so going back to that point, I wanted to add that in as well, as it takes some discipline. But I found that if I could get those distractions out of the way and then set time blocking, so I said, this is what I'm doing during this time, then it becomes a lot easier to not interfere if you have maybe a timer set and you don't have those distractions coming into your genius zone, if you will. So I just wanted to share that, because even though it may sound easy on the surface, it won't be easy at first to do. But once you create a habit out of it, you'll be blown away by how much more sanity you have when you don't have everything buzzing at the same time and you're not trying to multitask. So just wanted to finish that area off. But in terms of the other question, in terms of preparation, I guess this is the non-sexy answer, Mark. I'd love to give a great answer like, you know, I have this amazing system that just, you know, you plug this in and it pops out an interview in terms of 10 questions and all this. But for me, I learned by failing. So when I say that, what I mean is basically when I started my early interviews, I had questions ready. And what I would do to allow me to, as you said, prepare for so many interviews is I would basically I came up with, say, 12 standard questions that I could ask to almost any person in any environment. And then what I would do is I would just customize one or two questions. So I only really had to either remember, or I would revise it, you know, with a pen, or even just take my original standardized one and just change two questions. But what I would do is I had the standardized 10 questions or 12 questions. They were always the same. And then that way it was easier for me because I didn't have to prepare every single time. So the behind the scenes on that end, that was one of the things I did early on. That was when I was doing a lot of in-person interviews for the publication. With that one, it was a bit different than obviously when you're recording either live or recorded. And so then fast forward to the difference, let's say 5 years ago when I launched the show. The difference by then is I'd done so many interviews, like probably whatever the number at that point, 3,000, let's say. I had already done so many interviews that I was comfortable winging it. So what happened is, slowly but surely, once I transitioned over to the show, then I started actually, I would prepare. Okay, so I'll change this. I'll answer this two ways. I would prepare to the extent that I would research who I was interviewing. It helped a lot of the times the people I was reaching out to, I already knew their work. I was reading their books. I was listening to their, let's say if they had like a Brendan Burchard, I'd watch their YouTube shows. I'd watch their talks on YouTube. So I knew enough about them. And that was just my personal interest in keeping learning and keeping feeding my mind. So I knew enough about them on a research perspective to be prepared. But then I basically winged it with the questions. So I would just kind of say, here's some of the questions I want to ask. If I get there, great. But if I ask a question and then Mark brings me somewhere else, then I'll go in that opposite direction. So the preparation, like I say, it wasn't really as systemized as, you know, here's what I do every time for 2 hours before the interview. I actually would say my preparation, once I had those standard questions, was probably less than 20 minutes for the in-person interviews that were all for the print publication. And then for the radio show and podcast, the in-person and or phone or Skype or what have you interviews, those ones, I've really been lucky that I knew the people mostly. I knew their background, or I'd go research on their website for 15, 20 minutes and learn a base knowledge at least. And then the rest of it was really just winging it. So again, that's not the sexy answer, but that's how I made it work. So, I mean, if I put 240,000 minutes just into the interviews, I'd say probably maybe add another, you know, 50,000 in the preparation. So it certainly wasn't as much as the interviews themselves, but at the same time, I guess it still adds a lot more. It adds a lot of extra hours and minutes to the clock.
And I mean, it definitely adds on, but it's worth doing all that research because that just allows you to ask better questions on the fly. And I do appreciate you giving me that insight because it definitely helps me. I have changed my approach a little bit to lean more towards a direction that my guests take within the conversation than asking a bunch of pre-prepared questions. But I would like to transition back to some of the traits that successful people have in common and what you learned from interviewing all these people. So you already mentioned the power of no being something really, a really powerful trait that people seem to have. But what were the other two traits that really successful people tend to have in common?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the, you know, this next one probably won't surprise you and or listeners when they hear this, Mark, but and I'll title it as if I was writing an article and using this title, but the title would be Lifelong Learners Are Leaders. And so to dive into that, what I'm saying is that I've noticed these high achievers, they understand the importance of continuing to feed their mind. You know, they never look at their school or education as being done, if you will. Zig Ziglar had a great quote that went along the lines of, you can finish your school and it may be easy, but you'll never finish your education and it's seldom easy. And so what I believe he meant there was that you have to keep feeding your mind basically long after your formal schooling is done. So I've noticed that these thought leaders, they keep finding ways to gain the wisdom they need to gain to move that needle we talked about earlier. But they're very efficient at getting around the noise and the information that everybody else mostly gets bogged down in. So they get to the wisdom quicker they're efficient learners. So to give you an example, it could be that they listen to a podcast rather than reading, let's say, a 10-page blog. And, you know, that by doing that, maybe they can get a 10-minute podcast and get the same information that they may have otherwise spent an hour and a half reading. And then if they were on the blog, maybe they would get distracted and pulled in a different direction. Or they could watch an 18-minute TED talk versus watching a three-hour talk on YouTube. And so essentially, they become efficient learners. Sometimes it will take a book, you know, whether it's an audio book or a written book, for them to get the insight. But they always seem to find a way to get to that wisdom in an efficient way. And whereas it's a challenge for most people to actually get past all the information that drags you down and pulls you down and that we have to sift through to get to what is really going to move the needle. So efficiency of learning is one thing they do really well. I mentioned lifelong learners are leaders. I used to say readers are leaders. And then I realized, well, it matters what they're reading. So I switched that and said leaders are readers, because it's intentional. They know what they're reading. But the cool news is today, as you know, Mark, and as I know, you don't have to be a reader anymore. So we can learn by like a show like yours that we're involved in right now. I mentioned TED Talks. There's lots of ways we can learn. It doesn't have to be reading. It can be, but it doesn't have to be. So that's good news for the non-readers out there. But that's why I changed it to lifelong learners are leaders. It's because you can get the wisdom in a myriad of ways. It doesn't have to be one fixed way. But these high achievers, they're finding a way to get it. They're finding a way to get it efficiently. And really, this what's really cool about this is this isn't something that's brand new to us. To put that in perspective, if you think about it, the leaders of yesterday, like the Henry Fords, the Thomas Edisons, what did they all have in common? Even if they didn't finish grade 3 or 4, they all had personal libraries in their home. So even back close to 100 years, you know, they were still feeding their minds and realized that they could actually get to the top, perhaps even quicker than somebody that had tons of formal schooling, if they could figure out a way to get that wisdom and insight a lot quicker than the next person. And we actually were in Concord, Massachusetts, my girlfriend and I, and we went to Ralph Waldo Emerson's childhood home, and he was a prolific writer in the 1800s, and his library in his home, I would guess, would be bigger. It looked like it would be bigger than probably most of the public libraries at the time. Wow. And so, you know, this is, I don't think this is the coincidence. Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich, he talked about the power of being a learner. You know, he talked about Henry Ford, a great story about how somebody was, they tried to call him ignorant and said in a courtroom that they were basically suing him. And I can't remember the reasoning, but basically they're trying to prove that he was ignorant. And they said, because he didn't have this knowledge or that knowledge. And he said, but why would I need to fill my brain with that knowledge whenever I can call somebody into my office and get that insight and have somebody else do the work and spend the time on it and get that insight within 10 minutes. And so I believe that these high achievers have understood this for a long time, which is, again, how can I get to the wisdom and not have to spend my time wading through the information? And the good news is, even though we may not all be doing it now or know that this is possible, hearing this, what's really cool is you can start doing this tomorrow. There's nothing that stands in front of you doing this. So that was a long answer, Mark, but basically lifelong learners are leaders. They continue to feed their mind long after everybody else stops, and they know how to get that wisdom and knowledge way more efficiently than I guess you'd say most people do.
Thank you for sharing. I mean, those really great traits, Corey. And I feel like when we talk a lot about successful people in general, we focus on the success they've achieved. We focus on how they're these monumental figures who have achieved all the things that they've achieved. And I know you've been able to interview so many of them, get these three key traits that they all seem to have in common. But on the way to success, there are some shortcomings. And I'm wondering if you're able to see a pattern in some of the shortcomings that some of the successful people you interviewed had on their way to success.
Yeah, absolutely, Mark. And as we round things out, remind me to circle back and reveal the number one top trait as well. I won't take long to share it, but I want to make sure we give them that number one trait too. But yeah, in terms of the some of the shortcomings, one of them would be working in their business rather than on their business. And you know, if you want to really learn a lot about the power of working on your business, there's a great book called The E-Myth by Michael E. Gerber. And so basically what he talks about in the book is that most people struggle because, especially most entrepreneurs, that decide to spend most of their time working in their business. So that's where a lot struggles. So if we go to an example, I mentioned earlier when I did the interviews for my publication, working on the business for me at that time would have been if I was spending a lot of the days doing the accounting or trying to figure out how to publish the, you know, actually design things or standing beside my designer. That would be working in the business. And even the interviews, some people would have said was working in the business because it's not growing it. But basically, working in the business is when you're not growing the business, you're actually doing all the things inside the business that basically stop the business from growing. And again, it could be the accounting. Like maybe you spend one day a week doing the accounting when you could hire a freelancer to do the accounting and then spend that extra day in your genius zone, whatever that is, growing the business. So the first one I see is that, you know, maybe shortcomings that a lot of entrepreneurs, myself included, any of these things I'm sharing with you, Mark, I've learned by being in the trenches and I've made these same mistakes and I didn't know about these things and had to learn them myself. But first of all, for me, I spent a lot of time working in the business and I know a lot of entrepreneurs, I would say the vast majority early on, get stuck in the business and then it's hard for them to grow the business. Going and to add another one is I believe because entrepreneurs are passionate people and optimists, we love to start the business without basically having a safety net. So a lot of entrepreneurs start without either having a backup cash flow or some way to earn an income besides the business. And then what happens is, as we know, you know, the numbers are as high as 90% of all businesses fail in the first 3 to 5 years. And I believe it's because a lot of entrepreneurs are underfunded when they start because they start based on a circumstance that didn't allow them maybe 6 months or a year to prepare. So a second, let's say, shortcoming is, and it's not really a deficit as a person, it's just something that they didn't plan, is to have enough cash flow to carry them through the tough times that, as you and I both know, will come when you're running a business. So those are two shortcomings, I would say, or challenges that people have early on that they have to get past if they want the business to be successful. So working in the business is a challenge. So you should be working at least some of the time and hopefully most of the time on the business. And then having some sort of safety net or cash flow or something that can help you through those tough times so that you're not always basically just working on fumes financially and emotionally. I would say those are two big ones. And then we talked about the power of no earlier. I would say a lot of entrepreneurs early on say yes to everything because they're happy to have any opportunity come their way. And the challenge with that is to eventually make the switch so that you realize, okay, now there's a lot of opportunity coming my way. Eventually, I'm going to have to start making plans for how I'm going to say no to some of these things. So that would be another one, is just not knowing the importance to say no or just being scared to say no because you're scared the opportunities won't continue to come.
And those are definitely some really good shortcomings. I mean, that cash flow being a really big one, because I feel like a lot of entrepreneurs, they have that idea where they're in a job, like, oh, I'm going to make it as an entrepreneur. So they just leave everything behind right then and there. And in the long run, entrepreneurship is much safer because when you have a job, you're literally relying on one source of income. Like if you get fired or laid off or anything, like your source of income disappears. But You don't want to, in that short run, not have that cash flow coming your way that you can put back into your business. And there is one question that I'm really pressing to ask right now, because I feel like we could, I feel like it's a question that I definitely know needs to be asked. But just before that, I would love to hear about the third key trait, because the next question that I have definitely comes in line with all three of those traits.
Okay, well, perfect. And well, you know what? I'll save this, what I was going to say, until after your question, because it may be related to it. So I don't want to try to steal any thunder, but I want to mention something about the three traits as well, just when we're after your question. But before we jump there, the third trait, which is the good news is for entrepreneurs, this is the one that's easiest of the three to either have already in place when you go into business or to develop. I would say most entrepreneurs, and that's why it's probably the most common trait, most entrepreneurs already get this. Saying that, there's add-ons to it as well in terms of how you impact, how you use it. But what I've discovered is the top leaders, they are living on purpose more often than everybody else. So, you know, if we want to use the word passion, if we want to use the word why, you know, discovering your why, they know what their why is. They know what their passion is. They know what their purpose is. And those are two different things, your passion and purpose, in my opinion. I always say that passion is what you do. So what you're actually doing, purpose is why you're doing it. But these top leaders, they know what they're doing, what they want to be doing, and they know why they're doing it. Where we sometimes run into challenges is if you do know your purpose, it's first of all being focused on that purpose and not multiple purposes. A lot of entrepreneurs are multi-passionites, I'll call them. So myself included, it's easy for me to have multiple passions. But if I want to quote unquote move the needle like we talked about in the best way possible, I need to stay mostly focused. So first of all, the common trait is that they live on purpose, but the caveat to it is that some entrepreneurs struggle with actually having one purpose and living on that purpose. It doesn't mean you don't actually work on your other passions, but I'm just saying the one that you focus your core time on, your genius zone, should be the main purpose you're trying to serve. And then the secondary part is how do you tap into that so that you're spending more of your time on that purpose. So we talked about this earlier, but hiring for your weaknesses, hiring people to do the things that you might like, but you don't love. And so I found that these top entrepreneurs, these top leaders, they actually spend most of the time, sun up to sundown, living their purpose and spending their time in their genius zone. Whereas other people who are passionate can do their passion certain times of the day, but then also spend a lot of their time in the business or doing the things they don't like as much, simply because they don't maybe want to pay somebody else to do it. They don't see how it's possible. Whatever the reason is, they maybe struggle to spend as much time as the top leaders in that area. So that would be, I guess it ties back to that power of no, Mark. They're able to say no to all the things that are going to interfere, so they can spend 90% of their time on their purpose rather than maybe 50% or 60%. So that's a common trait, is that they live on purpose, but they also, I guess the add-on to that is the more they can spend that time living on purpose, it seems like the easier it is for them to achieve at the highest level.
Corey, thank you for sharing with us that final purpose, which is having that purpose, the final trait, having that purpose, my bad. But one of the things that, like all successful people do have these three traits, and obviously there's a lot of definitions for the word success, but in some cases, someone becomes really successful but then loses everything. So how do we maintain our success once we have it? Because you hear about millionaire, spends all money, goes broke, has to rebuild again. So how do we become successful but then stay there?
So interesting question, Mark. And I guess there's also multiple answers to this, in the sense that it depends what was the reason that they actually lost everything, if you will. So was it a matter of that they you know were able to acquire it, but they also spend quickly? So obviously there's a different answer if it's that they spend quickly versus if they let's say they acquire whatever that success is, but then they get complacent and they stop changing and stop adapting. Or maybe what they did worked before but won't work now, and they don't, you know, they haven't made the change. So it depends on the reason, but I'll give you two answers, which I would say would cover off the most common. So if it has to do with the idea that they spend as much as they make, there's a great example of somebody who shares how to sort of sustain this and retain what you've earned, and I don't mean necessarily just financially, but success-wise as well. His name is T. Harv Eker, quite well known in the speaking world, and he talks about how, I think it was twice, he became a multimillionaire and then also lost the money as well. And what he said was the challenge, the reason it was happening is because he had his what I think he calls his money blueprint, he had it set on spend. So the challenge was he was still the same person when he had the money and had the success as when he didn't, in the sense that he hadn't really changed and made the change he needed to make to basically sustain it and not overspend and all those kind of things. So I would say, go check out Harv Eker's stuff about resetting your money blueprint. If it's a matter of if it's money and then it's because you're spending as much or more than you're taking in, and it's not to grow the business or expand or what have you, maybe even if it is, maybe you have to look at your money blueprint and see if it's set on, a certain area. So what he maintains, which I don't disagree with, is that if you don't change you, the core of you, or anything about you, and he looks at your bank account today, in 10 years, unless something else changes, outside of winning the lottery or something, he can tell you within $500 what'll be in your bank account in 10 years' time because your habits haven't changed. So again, that's one area. That's if it's because you're basically spending as much as you're not keeping any more than you're making or bringing in from a revenue point of view. If it has to do with the other, which is, the person that starts a business, has a ton of success quickly, maybe because the market was desperately craving what they're doing, but then all of a sudden now it's flooded with competitors, or if it's because what worked for them when they started doesn't work now. And I would say this is more often the case. It comes down to flexibility and adaptability. So first of all, having the mindset that will allow you to adapt is huge, and then also being willing to adapt. So that would be kind of my two-part answer. Most people, I think, struggle with, like I say, getting complacent. They're still doing the same things they always did, and now it's not working, or there's new competitors, and they haven't figured out how to pivot and do things differently. Maybe they started with promoting, we're the lowest price, or we're the only game in town, and all of a sudden, when those things aren't applicable anymore, somebody else comes along, can offer a lower price, or a new competitor comes in, it's harder to still sell your brand in the same way if you're going lowest price and somebody new's in town. That's what happened to a ton of the stores that were promoting lowest price, and then Walmart came along, and then nobody could touch their price, and all of a sudden, those stores aren't in business anymore. So, Mark, I don't know. That's an answer I think that can... you can adapt it to any business, really, but really it's flexibility, adaptability, evolution of you and the business. And then the other side is figuring out how to make sure you're not spending more than you're bringing in.
Corey, thank you for sharing with us. I mean, those are some really key principles for maintaining our positions once we do reach that level of success, because we definitely do always need that drive. Because if you you have a really big goal right now to reach your level of success, but you need to now what also, you need to set the bar higher constantly, because if you get settled with where you are, that's when you can start to regress as well. And some people, they're still trying to reach that definition of success themselves. So with that in mind, Corey, what do you believe holds most people back from reaching their full potential?
Wow. And again, it's a big answer, Mark, because there's obviously variables. It depends on the person. There's a lot of things that come into play. For instance, mindset would be a massive one. So somebody who's gone into business for themselves, they believe in the business, they're passionate about what they're doing, but they don't have a positive mindset. They're saying, "Oh, I heard there's a recession coming, or this happened in the market, so I can't compete, or now there's a new competitor here. What's the point?" So one would be, I would say, mindset. Another would be time management, whatever term we want to put on that. But basically, the way they manage their time, they run out of time during the day, or they're constantly running in the wrong direction. Or as we talked about earlier, they're getting distracted all the time. So they're not actually really spending even a core amount of time focused. So lack of focus and time management would be another big one, I think, is something that trips a lot of people up. I think another one is what I'll call a scarcity mindset. So scared to talk to other influencers, talk to other people, get mentors, maybe talk to even people in your industry and say, "Hey, wonder what's working for you. Love to connect further and see if there's any way we can, chat with each other and see what works and what doesn't." there's a lot of people that are scared to have that conversation. In fact, I had somebody that I was working on a joint venture program, and they, and I won't go into much detail other than to say, I was launching the speaking program, which we've had multiple launches of, but it was one of the early ones, and she's in the book business. So she teaches people how to author books. And I mentioned that in the program, we had one person that was just going to talk simply about how do you write your book and market your book and what have you. And because of that, she said, I can't, and I didn't realize until we had a discussion later on, but that's where she was thinking. She thought the whole program was about that. But the point is that was what she did. And so I was had one component that was about authoring a book. And because of that, she said, well, you know, there's a conflict of interest. I could never partner in something like that. And so we had this conversation afterward, but I was blown away that her mindset was that if anybody else does anything to do with writing a book in any capacity, shape, or form, that's a competitor to her. And so she'll never talk to them or work with them. And so scarcity mindset. So, you know, Mark, those are three off the top of my head, but I could probably keep us 2 hours with different ones that I've seen. And you know, the challenge is, you know, which ones are the most common ones? Well, those three I mentioned would be the ones that I see the most. But again, it really varies because there's so many different personalities out there. And like I said, there's all kinds of things that can trip us up. Even just for some people, it's that they always have the phone glued on and, you know, they're answering calls in front of customers. They're, if they work online, they're always watching the phone. And then when the phone rings, they, or beeps or anything, they get pulled away for 2 hours and until they get back, and they get back for 10 minutes and then distracted again. So really there's a myriad of them, but that would be three that I would be on the lookout for if I were saying, what are some things that are tripping me up or could trip me up?
And those are some really great insights. I mean, there's so many, different things that prevent us from unlocking our full potential. I mean, we can go on for quite a while just on this one topic, but those are some of the key ones that definitely hold us back. And one of the things that also holds us back is that we do have to face certain challenges along the journey. Some people notice and like they face some really rough challenges, so they don't want to face another in some cases. So with that in mind, Corey, I'm wondering if you could share with us one of the big challenges you faced in your journey and a powerful lesson you learned during that challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess it's funny that the one that I would share relates to one of the areas that I said people should really have in place before they go into business, or at least to some degree have prepared or planned for. And I didn't. And I mentioned that all these things that I'm sharing, I've been down these manholes, I've made these mistakes. So when I speak to stuff, I'm not saying, hey, listen to me, I've always done it right. I think we learn more from our failures than our successes. And so for one of the biggest challenges I had was I had that publication I mentioned at 19. I ran that for roughly a year and I started with a lack of cash flow. So I had seed money from an entrepreneurial program that I had taken. The seed money was about $2,500, if I remember correctly. Each issue of the publication cost about $2,700 to produce. We had to sell advertising to pay for the publication. And so basically we had about a month's worth of backup or you know, safety net when we launched. And that wasn't even including my normal expenses. You know, thankfully, when I launched the business, I actually moved back in for the short term into my family place, like my with my mom. And that allowed me to avoid some of the expenses to run the business. But still, even in the first month, when you added everything up, the expenses for the first month were more than my safety net. And so I had to sell ads to pay for the publication. Well, on the plus side, first month, I sold about 3,000 in ads. So I technically paid for the publication. But with all the expenses I had outside the publication personally, and then the ongoing every month, $2,500 or $2,700 to publish the publication, what happened was it caught up with me after about 5 or 6 months. And all of a sudden, I'm in a situation where now the money's pretty much run out. And I either have to now oversell every issue. I have to sell at least double what it costs to produce a publication. Remember, I'm only like 5, 6 issues in. I'm 19 years old. I'd never sold anything in my life before this. And if I don't sell, then all of a sudden I'm going to have the creditors after me. So essentially what I did was I pushed as long as I could, but I also wanted to get out and did not burn bridges. So I wanted to make sure I could get out and not have any ads owing to anybody. I didn't want to have money that somebody had given me that I couldn't then pay back. So I had to make the right exit, and I exited pretty quickly after that timeline of that 5 or 6 months. Ran that business for about a year, did some consulting and a few other things, but the publication itself was close to a year, and I kind of jumped ship But I jumped ship in a way that I didn't burn any bridges. I didn't claim bankruptcy. I didn't have any cash flow left. And I pretty much had to start working pretty quickly to make money back. But I feel like I left it just at the last possible time before everything was going to fall upside down. And so that was the challenge. What I learned from it is, well, first of all, what I shared is in the future, make sure you have that cash flow in place, or you're running a business where your expenses aren't so high that the writing's already against you when you start. That would be one of the things I learned. What I learned other things too, though. I learned that the end of one thing is not the end of everything. So I learned that it wasn't the end of everything just because I let the business go. At the time, I kind of went into hibernation. I didn't want to talk to anybody about the business. I had been like a local kind of public figure for that short amount of time, and I didn't want to acknowledge that the business didn't succeed at the level I hoped it would. So I learned that, you know what, entrepreneurs have failures, and that it's actually would be abnormal not to have a failure. And I kind of realized the failure was sort of a badge of honor because I learned so much from it, and I grew from it, and I survived. I survived. I didn't die just because the publication, I decided to close the doors. So I learned that, again, that it's not the end just because it might seem like it at the time. And then what I learned a few years later, I took a position with a Fortune 500 company. And when I asked the guy why he hired me out of 170 some applicants, he told me two reasons. One, I had moved across the country, so he knew that I couldn't really quit the job as easy as somebody who lived in the local area. But the second reason was because I had a small business paper at 19 years old. And he said, anybody that can do that, because I was going into a sales role, he said, anybody that can do that, I feel they have the best chance of surviving this tough sales role. So what I found out, you know, Steve Jobs talked about joining up your dots and realizing these things that happen throughout your life, bad and good, actually are what was necessary to become the person you were later. So I got that Fortune 500 company position, which sort of launched my career in a different direction, mainly because I had this publication that basically failed. So at the end of the day, Mark, the challenge was having the business fail at a young age and having to suck that up and be humble enough to accept that. And what I learned from it was those lessons that I just shared, you know, the cash flow thing and the fact that the journey is necessary. And just because something seems like the end of the world at the time doesn't mean it will be in the bigger picture.
I feel like, I mean, it's a very, like you have to have a level of like no ego at all to have that level of courage and confidence to look at your failures as the way that you learn new things. Like some people, they just want to think about their successes, but it's the failure part where you really learn about how you can get better, how you can avoid making the same mistakes. So it's very admirable to take a deeper look at that side than just at the whole success part of the equation. And I know that you've learned so much by interviewing all the people. Like self-education is so important, and I got to do that by interviews and also by reading a lot of books. I'm sure you've read a lot of books yourself. So I'm wondering, Corey, if you could share with us three great books that you believe would have a positive impact on us.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to do that, Mark. And this is another area where, of course, I could flood people with all kinds of stuff because I'm an avid book reader. So I mentioned earlier, you don't have to be a reader to be a leader, but I am a reader. Didn't read the first book until I was 27 years of age, though. So I really started late in the game. But that's probably why I'm so passionate about reading now. So three books is tough for me, but I'm going to give you three. I have to say the ones that changed my life the most and the ones that changed the game for me the most. So the first one is How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. And that book was the first book that I read. So that was the 27 years of age book. My mother bought it for a quarter at a flea market, threw it in my kit bag. I didn't know I'd end up reading it. And long story short, nothing to do on this trip that we were on, this company trip, pulled out the book, started reading, hooked on the first page, never finished. You know, the hook never finished. I basically got through the book, read it a second time. So technically it's the second book I ever read. But I read it a second time because I loved it so much. And then the second true book I read, so right after that Dale Carnegie book, was Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. And so those two books were the biggest game changers. Ironically, maybe not ironically, they were both written roughly around the same time. I believe 1936, I believe they were both released, give or take a year. And so those are two big game-changing books for me, maybe because they were early on and because reading had hit me so hard at that time. And it was like, wow, there's, you know, I can now get the knowledge of somebody who's been passed away for years in this snippet and basically avoid some mistakes that I've been making on my own. And then the third book is a book I often say to me was a classic that just happened to be put out in modern times. And that book is called The Compound Effect by Darren Hardy. And Darren Hardy was is the former publisher of Success Magazine. So if people recognize the name, that's, you know, I think that's where Darren's most known from. But he released The Compound Effect while he was the publisher of Success Magazine. I grabbed that book and it was one of those immediate game change books. In fact, people ask me all the time how I am able to get so much done in the run of a day. And for years I used Darren's weekly rhythm register, he calls it, which basically takes your day, separates it down into takes your weeks, I should say, separates it down to each day and what you're going to do each day, and you check it off and reward yourself. So that system is what I use actually to start. Hopefully at the time I felt crush more goals in a shorter amount of time. And that was solely from that book, Compound Effect. So those are the three.
Corey, thank you for those great book recommendations. All three of them I can also strongly recommend to my audience because I've read them as well. There's such book, like if you haven't read them, like definitely read those books. So all those links will be at markaberry.com/E122 along with the show notes. But those are three really great books. And before we do come to the end of this episode, I'm going to flip the tables a little bit on you, Corey. So I've asked a bunch of questions throughout our time together, but what is one question that you believe we need to be asking ourselves more often?
Wow, that's a good one. Question we need to be asking ourselves more often. I would say, I'm going to relate this, Mark, to a question that I do ask. It's the central question I've asked ever since I asked it the first time. It's very, very seldom been an interview where I didn't ask this one question. So I told you I wing it a lot, but this question is one I always ask. And so I think it's a question we should ask ourselves, I guess is what I'm getting at. But the question is, what if you were able to sit across from a younger version of yourself? You know, so let's say the person's 40, I'm interviewing. If you're able to sit across from a 16-year-old version of yourself, I actually tell people to pick the timeline because you know when you were struggling the most or what you were dealing with. And if you could sit across from yourself and give your younger self one piece of life advice or business advice based on what you've learned since, what do you think you might tell him or her? And so I'm going to tell you what the common answer is. The most common answer I get is, I am enough. So it's okay. I'm on the right track. Variations of that answer. So people, like in other words, they will go back and tell themselves, stop stressing so much. You don't need to pressure yourself so much. Don't worry about that one setback. It's a part of the journey. And basically, they're just saying it'll all be okay. So what I would ask, you know, the question I would get people to ask themselves is, the thing that I'm worried about right now, how big of an impact will it make in 15 years? In other words, is it going to be stressing me in 15 years? Is it going to matter in 15 years? Will I remember I worried about it 15 years from now? So, you know, you might be more worried about, I said this wrong thing in a Facebook Live. And, you know, it was just something that somebody else made a comment about, but it wasn't like something you said that, you know, got you in trouble with the law or anything, but just something you said on a Facebook Live and somebody commented on it or a hater that came and hated on you. The question to ask yourself is, will you remember that or will it be that big of a deal in 10 or 15 years time? Because your older self will probably tell you, you know what, it's not that big a deal. So I would say ask yourself that question and really think about that answer.
Corey, I really love that insight and I can see why you saved this question. I mean, even after doing all four, I mentioned 4,000 interviews a lot, I know that, but it's just like you've asked so many different questions and that is the one question you continue asking people that you continue getting so much insight from. And I can see how we can get so much insight from that question. And breakthrough success listeners, that is definitely a question we need to be asking ourselves more often. If you want to learn more about Corey, he recently released his book on Amazon, The Book of Why. So really provocative book. You can definitely find it on Amazon. But in addition to the Book of Why, Corey also has a free gift for us. So, Corey, would you mind sharing with us what that free gift is?
Yeah, happy to, Mark. And I will say another place people can check out the book is thebookofwhy.com. So we have that Amazon page actually forwarding to that website and vice versa. So that's an easy way to find it if people want to save themselves from searching it on Amazon. But because it is a book, and, you know, I feel when it comes to reading somebody's writing or the writing style and knowing if it's going to impact you or resonate with you, Reading a book that they put out is a good way to do that, you know, to decide if you're going to actually purchase a copy of their book. So what I decided to do for your listeners is to actually set up a page where people can go and grab a free copy of my book called Enlightened. And so if you're listening to this and you want to grab a copy, it's over 100 pages. It has insight by, at the back of the book, quotes by some of the top thought leaders we've interviewed, some of the people we've been, you know, we were talking about what I learned from them today. That's in the book as well. So if you go to letsdoinfluencing.com, again, letsdoinfluencing.com, right on that main page, you can sign up and you'll get immediately a free copy of the book called Enlightened. And at the same time, you can find some more details about the new book there or go to thebookofwhy.com.
Corey, thank you for sharing with us that free gift. And don't forget to also take a look at The Book of Why, because it is a really good book. And Corey, I can't thank you enough for being a guest on the Breakthrough Success podcast. It was such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Mark. And thank you for all the stuff you're doing to push the needle. I've used that term a few times today, to push the needle for so many people in the right direction and for all the things you're doing to give so many people a purpose. So thanks for being you.
How does over 100 retweets per day sound to you? My free ebook, 27 Ways to Get More Retweets on Twitter, has you covered. I use the methods within this ebook to get over 10,000 retweets every single quarter. To learn more and get access to this free resource, visit markgoberti.com/retweets.